Okay, we continue our deliberations with business combinations under common control. And I give the floor to Anna Maria.
Yes. So I'll now take you through agenda paper 23. But first of all, let me clearly state the purpose of today's session, which is, of course, to provide you an update on the approaches we are currently still developing for transaction within the scope of the business combination on the common control project. But in particular, today, we will start by looking at a very specific subset of transaction within the scope. And of course, we will come back to you with other approaches for other transactions at future board meeting. But having in mind this specific subset of transaction, we want to get your initial reaction on our analysis. And but as stated in the slide deck, this is an educational session, so we won't ask you to make any decision today. Now, looking more closely to the content of our slide deck, so I'm now on slide 4. I will quickly remind you where we are on this project, and then I'll move to the approaches. And what we want to do today is really to walk you through our reasoning. So the question we ask ourselves, the conclusion we drew, and the approach we are developing based on those conclusions. And I will also try to illustrate how these approaches might work in practice using some numbers. And finally, I will try to summarize the key aspects of each approach at the end. And of course, I will pause from time to time to get your feedback. Now, where we are, very quickly, the board finalized the scope of the project in December last year, and I won't go into detail, but let me just remind you that we are focusing on the transfers of businesses under common control. And of course, we are looking at those transfers from the perspective of the receiving entity. Now, what else the board decided? So in February, the board decided to use the acquisition method as a starting point in its analysis. And as you all know, that decision does not mean that the board will propose the acquisition method to all, many, or even any transaction within the scope of the project. Now, moving to our analysis, as I said before, today we're focusing on a subset of transactions within the scope, and we decided to start from a simple scenario. So entity A and entity B are both controlled by the same controlling party, and entity A acquires entity B. And there are non-controlling interests in entity A, which is our receiving entity. And as an additional point to bear in mind is that in today's analysis, we will focus on the usefulness of information before applying the cost constraint. So cost constraint consideration will come at future board meeting. Now, if we look at slide 10, today we are really addressing the red dot in the top left corner. So you have to bear in mind that everything I'm going to tell you today is really only affects that subset of transaction. And as I said before, we will complete the picture, no worries, and we will look at other transactions at future board meeting. Now, considering the illustrative transaction I've just described to you, which is also illustrated in slide 11, we ask ourselves two questions. So let's start with the first question. So we ask ourselves, what information about the transaction is useful to non-controlling interests? So to NCI, and I'm now on slide 13. And why we focus on NCI? Well, because in the scenario we're considering, they need to rely on entity A's financial statement to get access to information about the transaction. And of course, we do acknowledge that the controlling shareholder, so entity P, is also a primary user, as defined in the conceptual framework, but arguably it has access to information about the transaction without necessarily relying on entity A's financial statement. So let's put ourselves into the shoes of this non-controlling interest and assume you have invested in entity A. So what do you want to know? So what information do you want to have? And you probably want information that helps you assess how the transaction has affected your investment. So you want to know whether what entity A gave away is more or less than the fair value of the business you acquired. So using the language of the conceptual framework, you need information to help you assess the prospects for future net cash inflows to Entity A and management stewardship of Entity A's economic resources. And once again, in the language of the conceptual framework, you need information about the impact of the transaction on Entity A's financial position, financial performance, and how efficiently and effectively management has used Entity A's economic resources. Now, moving to slide 14, what approach would provide you with such information? So, historical cost of Entity B? Well, if we allocate the consideration transfer to Entity B's identifiable net asset, we will fail to reflect the fact that Entity A actually acquired a business. So we will fail to recognize those intangible assets that are not identifiable. So we park that approach. So what about predecessor carrying amounts? So book values recorded in either B's financial statement or P financial statement, depending on how the predecessor method is applied. Well, in our scenario, if we account for the transaction using predecessor carrying amount, we will fail to reflect the impact of the transaction on Entity A financial position and performance. In fact, think about a transaction where I'm exchanging a consideration whose book value is 10, and I'm acquiring a business whose book value is also 10, but its actual fair value is 1, just 1. So using predecessor carrying amount, I won't be able to see it. So therefore, we concluded that in order to assess what's really going on with the transaction, NCI need to know what are the fair value exchange. So the fair value of what I'm giving away and the fair value of what I'm receiving in exchange. And that will allow me to assess the economics of the transaction. And we also concluded that information about the fair value exchange will be useful for NCI, regardless of the characteristic of the transaction. So regardless of the purpose of the transaction, how the transaction was negotiated, the form of the consideration, or even whether the transaction occurred on market term or not. Well, in fact, if a transaction is on market terms, using fair value will reflect it. But if a transaction is not on market term, well, using fair value exchange is even more important because it is the only way for NCI to know how the transaction has really affected their investment. Now, how does our conclusion relate to IFRS 3? And I'm now on slide 16. Well, first of all, it is consistent with the conclusion the board made when developing IFRS 3, so that the acquisition method provides the most useful information about an acquisition. And then, reflecting the transaction at fair value exchange will be, again, consistent with IFRS 3 requirements to measure both the consideration transfer and Entity B's identifiable net asset at fair value. Now, let's have a look at the second question we ask ourselves, which is on slide 17. And this is probably arguably a more general question, so it's not necessarily related to the scenario we describe. Anyway, we ask ourselves, is there anything specific about a business combination under common control that need to be reflected in financial reporting and does not occur in a normal business combination, so in a business combination not under common control? And our answer is yes, there is. And in fact, unlike business combination not under common control, a BC's UCC might include a transaction with owners acting in their capacity as owners. A contribution or a distribution. And if we apply IS1, such transactions are recognized, need to be recognized in equity. So now, acknowledging that there might be an equity transaction in a business combination under common control and recognizing such transaction will be in a way consistent with IFRS 3 because there are paragraph 51 and 52 in IFRS 3 actually requires you to identify any amount that is not part of the exchange for the acquiree and recognize any such amounts in accordance with applicable standard. This conclusion would also be consistent consistent with accounting for some other transaction under common control. So let's think about an intercompany interest-free loan. So applying IFRS 9, an entity will need to recognize it at fair value and account for any difference from the transaction price as a contribution to equity from the parent. And finally, this conclusion will suggest that any bargain component in a BCUCC constitute a contribution to equity rather than a gain in profit and loss. Now, to summarize our conclusion so far, so slide 18, considering the specific scenario we described and from the perspective of the receiving entity, we conclude that fair value exchange provides useful information for to NCI in entity A, and we also conclude that a business combination under common control might include an equity transaction that need to be identified and accounted for. So somehow we will need to combine the acquisition method with the requirement in IS1. Now, before I move to the details, is there any question on what I've told you so far? If not, I'll continue the discussion and then probably I'll pose right after the method. Yes. Now, let's think about how IFRS 3 works for a normal business combination, so a business combination not under common control. So IFRS 3 assume that the fair value of the consideration transfer approximates the fair value of the business acquired. So therefore, it requires you to calculate any goodwill by comparing the fair value of the consideration transfer against the fair value of the acquired identifiable net assets. And of course, in reality, the fair value of the consideration might be slightly lower or slightly higher than the fair value of the business acquired. And in the first case, IFRS 3 tells you to recognize a gain in profit and loss, but it's a very rare circumstance. And in the second case, the entity might have actually overpaid the acquired business, but any actual overpayment will be captured by the impairment test of goodwill. Now, in a business combination under common control, we cannot assume that the fair value of the business, that the fair value of the consideration transfer approximates the fair value of the acquired business. The transaction is not negotiated between unrelated parties, and the controlling party might actually decide to set the consideration at zero or to a random number that might differ from the fair value of the business. Now, the difference between these two values, so fair value of the consideration and fair value of the business, would then constitute a distribution from equity or a contribution to equity. So therefore, in a business combination under common control, it will be important to both, first of all, avoid recognition of any inflated goodwill and any artificial gain, and secondly, recognize any equity. Now, from these two objectives, we ask ourselves, how we make it operational? And we thought of two alternative approaches that consider what I just explained. And we call them full fair value approach and ceiling approach. And as you will see, they place a slightly different emphasis on the two objectives I've just mentioned. And before I move to the description of these two approaches, I'd like to emphasize that they are both work in progress. So we are still refining them, but we wanted to give you an idea of how they might work and get your initial reaction. So full fair value approach, slide 23. Well, this is the most conceptually pure approach between the two, and it focuses on identifying and recognizing any equity transaction. So according to this approach, the receiving entity would always need to calculate the fair value of the acquired business, and it will be required to compare it against the fair value of the consideration transfer, so the red line on the picture, and the fair value of the acquired identifiable net assets, so the black line. And any difference between the fair value of the business and the fair value of the consideration will be recognized as either a contribution or a distribution, from equity, whereas goodwill would always be measured as the difference between the fair value of the business and the fair value of the acquired identifiable net asset. And for the reason I explained before, gain is never recognized. It's a contribution from equity instead. And as you can see, well, this method not only requires to calculate the fair value of the business, but it bases the recognition of any distribution or contribution and as well as goodwill on that number. So we do acknowledge and we do recognize that the approach might be subject to a high degree of measurement uncertainty, but we will come back to it later. Now, moving to the ceiling approach, so slide 24. These methods mainly focus on avoiding recognizing an inflated goodwill or artificial gain. And again, it does require measuring the fair value of the acquired business, but this number will only be relevant for accounting when the fair value of the consideration is higher than the fair value of the business acquired. So in this circumstance, the approach will work exactly as the full fair value approach. So goodwill will be recognized as the difference between fair value of the business and fair value of the identifiable net asset, whereas you will need to recognize a distribution as the difference between the consideration and the fair value of the business. But if the fair value of the business is higher than the fair value of the consideration, then, well, this approach will work exactly as IFRS 3. So with the difference that any gain will be recognized in equity as a contribution rather than in profit and loss. So in this circumstance, goodwill will be capped at the fair value of the consideration transfer. So now, probably the best way to understand the mechanics of the two methods, compared to IFRS 3, is to play with numbers in different scenarios. So maybe we can move to slide 26 and I will quickly go through the different scenario. So first of all, we assume that the fair value of the business is always higher than the fair value of the identifiable net asset. And under this assumption, well, actually, there are just three only possible scenarios. So either the consideration is higher than the fair value of the business, scenario one, or the fair value of the consideration is less than the fair value of the business, but higher than the fair value of the identifiable net asset, so scenario two, or scenario three, the fair value of the consideration is less than both the fair value of the business and the fair value of the identifiable net asset. So let's start with scenario one. So fair value of the consideration more than the fair value of the business, slide 27. And in this scenario, the two approaches work exactly in the same way. So there is no difference between the full fair value approach and the ceiling approach. So goodwill will be the difference between the fair value of the business, what I receive, and the fair value of the identifiable net asset, whereas the difference between the consideration transfer and the fair value of the business will be recorded as an equity transaction, and in particular as a distribution from equity. So if we look at debit and credit compared to IFRS 3, so slide 28, well, in both in IFRS 3 and according to these approaches, I will, well, credit cash transferred or the consideration transfer, I will recognize the identifiable net asset acquired at fair value, but under the full fair value and the ceiling approach, I will only recognize a goodwill of 12, which is the difference between fair value of the business and identifiable net asset, and the residual 10 will be a distribution from equity. Whereas under IFRS 3, I would initially recognize a goodwill, which is the difference between the consideration transfer, so 70, and identifiable net asset. So it would be like a goodwill of 22. But of course, this goodwill will be tested for impairment. Now, if we move to scenario two, so scenario two is when the fair value of the consideration is less than the fair value of the business, but still more than the fair value of the acquired identifiable net asset. And in this case, the two approaches work in different way. So let's start with the full fair value approach. According to the full fair value approach, I will recognize the goodwill as the difference between the fair value of the business and the fair value of the identifiable net asset. Whereas the difference between the fair value of the business and the fair value of the consideration will be recorded as an equity transaction, so a contribution from my parents. So I received something who worth 60 and I paid 52, so I will recognize this 8 as a contribution from my parent. But the same exact scenario and the ceiling approach will give us a different accounting. So under this scenario, I want, basically, this scenario will work exactly as IFRS 3, so I don't care about the fair value of business. I do care about the difference between the consideration transfer and the fair value of the identifiable net asset, and I will recognize this difference as my goodwill. So moving to debit and credit, so slide 31, you can see immediately that the ceiling approach and IFRS 3 will provide the same answer, whereas under the full fair value approach, I will recognize the entire goodwill and the full contribution from my parent. Now, very quickly, moving to the third scenario. So the third scenario is when the fair value of the consideration transfer is less than the fair value of the business and less than the fair value of the identifiable net asset. And once again, in this case, the two approaches work differently. So starting from the full fair value approach, I will still recognize my goodwill as the difference between the fair value of the business and the fair value of the identifiable net assets, so still 12. But I will then recognize the entire contribution from my parent as the difference between the fair value of the business and the fair value of the consideration. Whereas under the ceiling approach, so slide 33, I will once again cap my contribution and I will apply an accounting treatment which is similar to IFRS 3, with the only difference that in this case I won't recognize a gain in profit and loss, but I will recognize an equity transaction, so a contribution, which is the difference between the fair value of the identifiable net asset and the fair value of the consideration. So again, once again, moving to the debit and credit, slide 34, you can see immediately that ceiling approach and IFRS 3 are quite aligned, with the difference that under IFRS 3, I would recognize a gain in profit or loss, whereas under the ceiling approach, I will recognize a contribution from my parents, so directly equity. Whereas under the full fair value approach, once again, I will recognize the full goodwill of 12 and the full equity contribution of 15. Now, I'll quickly recap the two methods and then I open the floor to so, very quickly, the full fair value approach, you have to calculate to measure the fair value of the acquired business, and based on this number, you will recognize both your goodwill, if any, or your distribution and contribution, again, if any. And of course, the goodwill is always the difference between the fair value of the business and the fair value of the identifiable net asset, and then the difference between the consideration and the fair value of the business can be a contribution or a distribution based on the sign of the difference. And of course, as you can see, the full fair value approach aims to reflect the real value, so the real economics of the transaction. However, it involves significant measurement uncertainty, as well, everything is kind of based on this number, this measurement, this measure of the fair value of the business. And in addition, we also recognize that it might be operationally complex, especially for transactions that are not priced at fair value. Whereas the ceiling approach, well, It does require you to calculate the fair value of the business, but this number will only affect recognition of goodwill if the fair value of the consideration is higher than the fair value of the business. So if my consideration is even less than the fair value of the identifiable net asset, I will recognize a contribution, so I don't care about the fair value of the business. If my consideration is higher than the fair value of the identifiable net asset, well, I need to check in what circumstance I am. So if I am in a circumstance where the fair value of the consideration is higher than the fair value of the business, then I will apply exactly the same approach as in the full fair value approach, so goodwill and distribution. Whereas in the other case, so if this consideration is less than the fair value of the business, I will recognize a goodwill, which is the same goodwill I will recognize under IFRS 3. So the ceiling approach will not always fully reflect the economics of the transaction, but it might involve less measurement uncertainty compared to the other approach. But it will share similar operational complexity. And just one couple of things I want to emphasize before leaving the floor to the discussion is that, of course, if a transaction is on market term, the two approaches will work exactly in the same way, and they will work exactly as IFRS 3. And the second point I'd like to stress, and this is maybe even more important, is the picture we have in slide 43. So I really like to remind you that these approaches work, and we are proposing these approaches. We are developing these approaches just for a very specific subset of transactions. We still need to complete a picture. We still need to figure out what is the accounting treatment that might work for other transactions within the scope of our project. And arguably, we will need to draw two different lines. So the first line will be think about the cost constraint and think about the primary user of my financial statement, because I might have an acquisition that between wholly owned entities, so no NCI, and probably the benefit of fair value information is not justified by does not justify the cost of applying fair value. So we really need to think about this line, and of course we do know that this line might also involve consideration about what to do with debt holders or how to define substantial NCI. Another line we need to draw is about the transaction itself. So we do acknowledge that for an acquisition, fair value exchange is useful information. But what if I just have a transfer of business under a new co, so a wraparound an existing entity, so a continuation of the business? Well, maybe in these circumstances, the acquisition method and fair value exchange are not useful information. So I really want to stress that everything I explained to you today is related to that specific subset of transaction. And I will...
If I may, just one request for the board. So in what Anna just described, there are, in our view, two distinct parts. One is sort of the conceptual element, which is fair values, and if there is an equity transaction, we need to capture it. So that's sort of the conceptual anchor, if you will. And then the next question is, okay, how does it translate into accounting methods and approaches? And this is the second part. Mm-hmm. So if you have comments and questions on both parts, that would be helpful.
Yes, this is a really impressive and good analysis of all possibilities. So just some clarification. So based on your example, maybe it's easy to communicate to each other. So in the case of scenario one, there is a case here and the bottom debits and credits here. So in this case, the reporting entity is entity A, right?
Yes.
We are not talking about consolidated. statement. Just the entity A is individual.
Well, no, we're talking about
entity A consolidated financial statement.
Entity A's.
A's consolidated financial statement. So entity A acquired entity B.
Yes.
Now it has to prepare consolidated financial statement. So we are looking at the accounting method to account for this transaction in entity A's consolidated financial
statement. So there is a P here, and there is entity A and entity B. So we are talking about the entity A's journal entry and this financial statement. Yeah, okay. The next one is... you said that for the NCI of entity A, the fair value of this exchange is very important. I understand that's very critical to the NCI. And also you said that the only information for the NCI is this financial statement, or there are some other internal information.
Not for the NCI, for the parent company, they have may have access to other.
Mm-hmm.
But NCI would only have access to the financial statements.
Yeah. So this is the only information for the available to the NCI.
We should assume that, right?
Yes.
Yep. Assuming that.
In our
principle, that's the concept, yeah.
So the NCI says that they are kind of approval of this business combination when they know this financial statements. Before that, they do not say anything.
So, well, all the discussion related to prior approval from NCI depend on, well, jurisdiction.
Uh-huh.
So in our very simple scenario, we assume that NCI need to rely on financial statement in order to get access to information about the transaction. So we implicitly assume that any other way to get this information. And of course, in some jurisdiction, they probably will have this information even before, but it's still, well, if you think about it, it will still be information about the fair value exchange. In order to properly assess the transaction, they will need to have information about fair value exchange. So,
yes.
And I think what's important, again, so this is aligned with how conceptual framework describes primary users. These are the users who rely on financial, on general purpose financial statements as the main source of information about the reporting entity. So for the purpose of this analysis, we ask ourselves a question, what information does NCI need about the transaction? And they will get this information from the financial statements of entity A.
Okay. That primary users are, that's another issue on this issue. NCI is not the only one. Subsequently of this business combination, their entity A will publish every periodic financial statements and annual statements. In that case, potential investors might be the primary ones. In this case, you know, maybe the parent and the NCI have same incentive to publicize the subsequent financial statement because they would like show their business better. Now, that's the same incentive. So I'm saying that there may be three different times of the information, the date, the time of the business combination, so-called acquisition date, and maybe 1 or 2 years earlier than date, there is some kind of a deal negotiated among these old shareholders. Another timing is maybe 1 year later, after this business combination date, there is some kind of financial information. So maybe there are many, many different types of financial statements, but we need to investigate information available to investors at these three different times. Then they will make this proposal more persuasive. That's one.
Just a couple of observations. So first of all, again, under conceptual framework, financial statements do not provide information about future transaction and events unless it's necessary to meet the objective of financial reporting. So before the transaction happened, other than some disclosures, there is no information about this future transaction in the financial statements. That said, of course, we agree that NCI is not the only primary user. The parent is also the primary user. Potential investors are primary users. But then, arguably, first of all, parent has access to information other than from financial statements of entity A. So that's the first point, which is important. And second of all, if we compare existing NCI and any sort of future investors, if you are an existing NCI, this transaction affects you. If you are a future potential investor, then you invest sort of in an entity that already acquired that business, so it's a slightly different consideration for them. And in our slide 43, it will fall elsewhere rather than in this red dot. So that's to come back.
So one last thing is, this is okay, but if we expand this discussion into the parents' consolidated statements, it seems to me there's no substance here. Just cash from entity A moves to entity B, but from the perspective of parent, just no change at all in the balance of cash. So the parent might think there's no substance in this transaction. So there are two different perspectives. Yeah, I understand from entity perspective, it might have a kind of fair value information might be very useful, right, from the perspective of parents.
And we are making very clear that we are looking at this transaction from the perspective of
entity A. Okay.
Daryl.
Just on that last point, I suppose there is one potential impact on the parents' accounts, which may be on the valuation of NCI.
Yes.
So particularly if the transaction is done off market, that may have an impact. But otherwise, I broadly agree with what you're saying, especially from an accounting perspective. I think I like the analysis. I think it's a really nice analysis, really helpful to work the way through the process. And I largely like where you've landed about thinking about whatever that gap is as either a contribution or distribution. I think that also makes sense. I also agree that the focus should be on the NCI. I think that is conceptually correct. Well, and I'm using the term NCI, I suppose, for anybody who does not have access, any stakeholder that does not have access to information from another source. So debt holders, anybody else in A may be in the same sort of position as NCI.
Just one point to note. I think we would need to come back to debt holders in entity A, just because debt holders compared to equity holders are subject to different risks, and we need to just think really carefully about the cost-benefit side and what information they need. But otherwise, we need to think about all types of external stakeholders.
Absolutely. And I was going to say there are a couple of other things here. One is that I think we still need to come back and think overall about the cost-benefit analysis of the whole approach. I agree in the TIAP and others where you've focused quite a lot on the measurement uncertainty, and I think there's a lot of measurement uncertainty in this. So far, very comfortable with where you've got to. I did have one question, and I think that question then starts to kick on to a couple of other things. So in slide 20, you say that the in a business combination not under common control, the consideration transferred would normally approximate the fair value of the acquired business. I think the difficulty there is very often the consideration transferred captures the value of the acquired business plus some portion of expected synergies that will result from the... Now, I don't know what you're thinking about that some portion of, and I don't know where that comes into the equation, but that sort of flows through all the rest of the slides. And then I think there are a number of people who say that we shouldn't be thinking specifically about special consideration for NCI because the NCI have knowingly invested in a group like this. So knowingly invested in a... And in that knowingly invested, this synergy that I've just spoken about actually arguably pre-exists in the group even before this transaction happens. It exists because the holding company has a motivation or an incentive to encourage the synergies between the two subsidiaries. And that starts to complicate the transaction. So I think when we heard it, I think, Amara, we heard it, the Emerging Economies Group, where at least one party there felt quite strongly that these transactions are different, even though there's NCI. And it's that difference is NCI knowingly has exploited the synergies before. And now when I come to try and value the transaction, it complicates the transactions because the synergies actually pre-existed. So I think it's just flagging those up as a point. Broadly, my comments at the beginning still hold. I think this is a very nice analysis to work through, a very understandable analysis to work through.
Darrell, just two very quick sort of comments on your comments. So first of all, with respect to synergies, so it's not just the fair value of the business. They can pay a little bit more for the synergies. We are thinking about it, and that's why Anna highlighted that this is work in progress. And at the future meeting, we will take you further how we can capture that mechanically, so we're thinking about those. And then with regard to knowingly investing in a group, etc., agreed, but you can also have a situation where you invest in something which is not under common control, and then subsequently someone gains a controlling stake, and subsequently there is a business combination under common control. So in this case, that logic wouldn't work.
Yeah, I also think it's a good analysis. I have only one question, because I think in this scenario where we have minority interest and you have a transaction, maybe have fair value of the business is higher than the fair value of the consideration. And wouldn't you, as a non-controlling shareholder, sue that management immediately if you find that out?
Sue. Make a claim.
Because management has done a transaction under common control with influence and by the parents, which then they have to recognize in accounting that the fair value was higher what they have given, what they have received. And I would say in certain jurisdictions, maybe where I come from, that is even not allowed. I think you would have to go immediately to court if you're doing this kind of transaction. And then my question is, if we doing this accounting model based on that, is that a realistic scenario? Would it be ever that a management could conclude, if you have to come up with what is the fair value of the business is different from the fair value of the consideration received, is that a realistic scenario? Because, as I said, if I would in this scenario be in kind of NCI, I would immediately go to court and say, okay, management has not done their perspective because they have given more to the controlling shareholders and I have not taken any part of that.
Darrell, that made you very animated. Do you want to say something before the staff responds?
I certainly think it's a starting point. I think there are jurisdictions where that is not necessarily written into the law. And perhaps most importantly, there are a number of jurisdictions where there is no mechanism by which the NCI can police whether that has been done. I'll send you a really interesting article on a particular transaction. So I think that's the first thing. But I think in some ways, and that's why I think we have to be quite careful about this valuation exercise I talked about earlier. Because inherently, if the purchase price includes the value of the business and includes something else for the synergies, and we reflect that as one of your green blocks at the bottom, as essentially a distribution because you paid more, that is making a judgment on precisely the point that Martin's... It's implying that there was an overpayment. But I think there are jurisdictions where the protections aren't as strong as you're assuming.
Mary?
I'll add to the chorus of congratulations in terms of a very good and thoughtful analysis. I did have a question that sparked a bit by Darrell's comments about the excess paid, and then I want to offer a suggestion about how we think about, you know, the analysis and in particular NCI. The question I have about something Darrell said in, you know, the quote, the green box, is, you know, you're making a distinction early on, and it was a good reminder about BizCom, which is if we're accounting for a transaction that's within the scope of IFRS 3, we say compare the fair value of the consideration paid to the fair value of the identifiable acquired assets and assumed liabilities, and that difference is goodwill. And that difference is really the difference between the identifiable assets, liabilities, and the value of the business, because we're assuming that whatever you pay is the value of the business, and that that payment in excess of the identifiable assets and liabilities is, I think, that's what I would call the synergies. So it's within the business. It's the difference between value of the business all put together and the fair value of the identifiable assets and liabilities assumed. So, no? Okay, so this is...
Yeah, no, not necessarily, because, like, fair value of the business, if you take the perspective of a market participant, then, of course, it's just fair value of the business. But if you want to buy...
And something that may be
entity-specific. Synergies.
Okay,
it's
that's,
different
sorry, I wasn't getting the entity-specific synergies in addition to the market participant. Okay, that's a helpful clarification. When I was going through this, I thought it was a very good analysis. I did begin to worry that we were starting down a path that would end up in a much bigger version of IAS 2, and the carrying value of inventory is the lower of X or Y, and you know, you can explain the mechanics, but it's really hard to describe what we're trying to do. And when I stepped back and thought about the basic questions you were asking, slide 12, question 1 and question 2, I think in this case I'd actually ask question 2 first, which is say, when we have business combination transactions, that is the acquisition of a business, in the context of common control, I'm less worried about NCI, is there anything different about those transactions from ordinary business combinations that we should be thinking about in terms of our approach? Basically, your question too. And I think you've identified the right thing, which is it's much more possible that in such transactions there may be an embedded capital contribution distribution because of the common control relationship. You don't have anywhere near as strong a basis for assuming that consideration paid equals fair value of business. Okay? And I think if we attack that question first, we come to either the full fair value or the ceiling approach as responses to it. And I can see why, as we work through this analysis, we might have a preference leaning towards the ceiling approach. But rather than describing the mechanics, I think what I would say is one of our objectives is that we're trying to identify whether there is an embedded capital contribution or distribution, and to recognize and account for it. But recognizing the measurement uncertainty relating to goodwill more generally, that we're going to account for it, you know, in a more limited way, and not have a gross up of the transaction amount to, you know, full goodwill. We'll recognize goodwill to the extent it's present, and to the extent it appears that you've made a bargain purchase, recognize that as a capital contribution rather than a gain through P&L, and focusing on the nature of it being transaction among entities under common control, and explain measurement uncertainty for why you might go to a modification rather than you characterized it as the most conceptual. And then if I ask question 1, does this provide useful information for NCI? I think the answer is yes. You know, it does, because you can see what's happening in terms of the related party transaction. You may be in a jurisdiction where there's legal protections, in which case you'd expect the pricing to not throw out any capital contribution or distribution. And we may just have to think about that entity-specific synergies that I hadn't clicked on before. But if you're in a setting in which you are perhaps not as protected, it's useful to have information about that. So I would turn around the questions and express the objective of what we're trying to do. I do think that we are, as you say, going to have to do a pretty robust cost-benefit considerations, but at least in the circumstance we're focused on the nature of the transaction, what's different about the nature and how we're responding to it. And I have seen in practice these embedded transactions separated out when they were so screamingly obvious, even if there wasn't NCI involved, that you couldn't pretend that the stated transaction price was a meaningful representation of the business combination. But that, you know, that's when it's really extreme, it hits you in the face and you have to do it. And I think it's the exception rather than the rule to stop and think about that. And I think that's a very important characteristic of common control transactions that we should be focused on.
Jing Shao?
Thank you. First of all, I also appreciate the staff's analysis. It's a very good analysis. I have several questions. First thing that whether, because we're focused on NCI, so conceptually, whether the information needs of NCI is different from the controlling party, conceptually, because we are talking about a general purpose financial reporting, and eventually that financial reporting will normally be consolidated. And currently, if we look at the conceptual framework, we didn't distinguish those primary users, especially the investors, whether it's controlling or NCI, whether they have different information needs or not. Mm-hmm. And also, the conceptual, the consolidated financial statements were based on the entity concept, not the parent entity. So that means we treat the NCI and the parent at the equal level if we look at the balance sheet at the equity component. So I think we should have very strong fundamental concept underlying what different information needs of between the NCI and the controlling party. If I look at the slide 13, we identified that NCI need information to help them to assess. I think, and also to make those assessments, NCI need information about the followings. Actually, from my point of view, controlling party also need those information. They also need those information to assess the future cash flow and the stewardship, something like that. I cannot see the difference between the NCI and the controlling party's information needs. So this is the first question I would like to ask.
Can we answer the first question before you move to the second?
So
we definitely agree with you, and I think we already touched upon this in the earlier discussions, that NCI is not the only primary user of Entity A's financial statements. Parent is also part of the primary users as defined in conceptual framework. Any external debt investors would also be part of primary users. So here we are looking at NCI only, but of course there are other parties that are primary users. This is the first observation. The second observation is that arguably, information needs of NCI and parent are different. And the reason for that is that from the point of NCI, there was an acquisition by entity A of entity B. But then from the point of view of parent, it's a different transaction. It's not an acquisition. It's moving from one pocket into another pocket. Yes. So in one entity you have disposal, in another entity you have an acquisition. Yes. So it's a different transaction. And I think what parent needs to assess the impact of the whole transaction on itself. So it's the second point. And lastly, as we already discussed, unlike NCI, parent does have access to information about what happened other than from financial statements of entity A and entity B, but we will, of course, address all those points in a future board paper.
Yes, I see, because we cannot prepare two separate sets of general purpose financial reporting. We only provide one to meet all those users, including parent and NCI. So in this case, based on the example we gave, whatever we are going to using for fair value approach or ceiling approach. And from parent perspective, even the entity A, using those fair value-based, you know, approach, but the parent company, they will see that there are no any changes. They're just moving one pocket to another pocket. Even as Daryl said, the synergy, even before the business combination happened, the synergy has been there from the parent perspective. So even the entity A using fair value, and then the parent company's perspective, they have to reverse those fair value measurements to the carry amount. So because they don't think those information useful for
and,
them.
And I think that's all. I think all those arguments are valid, and I think there are also things we'll need to come back when we look at the cost benefit type of things. But
yeah.
I think to focus the discussion today, the staff really want us to focus in on the NCI perspective,
yes.
Sort of intentionally in isolation, if that's okay.
I just asked a question. Second, even the second question, even the information needs are no problem. And I agree that maybe that different ability for NCI to get access to those information. Parents maybe know everything, yeah. But NCI maybe not yet. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I think in some jurisdiction, and most of jurisdiction, if that company is a listed company, in order to protect the interest of the NCI, normally, because it's the related party transactions, those information relevant, those information will inform both NCI. NCI will know that interest, and they will involve in the decision making. They will vote. Even the vote, the controlling party will avoid to participate in the board meeting because they are related parties. So I think NCI can get access to the transaction and the relevant information. In practice, they will know because also the listing companies, they will disclose all the information gradually once because it's a whole process, not one day decision. So this is the second point I would, whether it's really NCI cannot get access to those information. And the third one is that about the question of slide 17. Slide 17, we said that VCUCC may include a transaction with owners acting in their capacity as owners. I agree because. But here, actually, we did not distinguish the owners, whether those owners NCI or controlling party. We regarded that all those owners as a whole. So I think, and all the examples, we did not regard all the, from the NCI perspective or parent perspective, because we think there's a whole. So I think there's an inconsistency there. And also think that we say that from transaction perspective, it seems that we are dividing two separate transactions. One is regarded contribution and discontribution, one is not. But when the owners make a decision of actually those transactions as a whole, they will not think that, okay, one part or another, one part is contribution or discontribution, one is market-based transaction, something like that. I think it's very difficult to distinguish which part is you know, the substance different with other part. The decision-making process will not think there are different components there. So this is The fourth is that about the operational challenges, or even we say the measurement uncertainties, because we started from the acquisition method as defined IFRS 3, but there is a very significant difference between our model or examples given
and with the IFRS 3. Here, whatever the four fair value model and the seeding model, there is a very important notion is that provided that acquires the fair value of the acquired business could be available, then we can justify what kind of goodwill should be recognized and how much of the distribution and contribution. But acquisition method and IFRS 3 only started from the fair value of the consideration. When we did not try to measure the asset that the business we acquire.
Because
so it's a significant difference there. And in practice, I think it's very difficult to measure the business you acquire, especially for those big merger transactions. If that company have 100 subsidiaries in different countries, and the parents will not think, okay, we shouldn't fair value all those assets first and then come to make a decision. I think it's cost, it's relevant to cost. It's cost too much, and conceptually whether it's right to, based on our whatever the seeding approach or four fair value approach, starting from the fair value of acquired business, I think it's really difficult.
I think you're right, Jing Chao. So the staff are highlighting the fact that the sort of working assumption in IFRS 3 that there should be a sort of symmetry between the fair value of the consideration and the fair value of the business doesn't necessarily hold, which is why you're suggesting this. But you're right, there's measurement uncertainty and cost, which I think we're going to come back to. So we'll have to come back to those.
Yes, and the final point is the slide 43. I think slide 43 is very useful to give us a full picture and what's next step, what we are going to do. My question is that I do hope that we should have one accounting measure to all the transactions included in the scope of BCUCC. If we are going to have different accounting approach for different kind of transactions, then we come to a very difficult situation. How to give the bright line for different transactions, I think it's different. It's very difficult. For NCI, maybe 1% of ownership belong to NCI, whether they belong, and another is 100%, there is no NCI. What's the difference between them? So yeah, I think in practice, sometimes it's very difficult. Even we go to whatever the approach we are going to use, I think we should try to bring one method for all the transactions, provided that the transactions are substantially the same and in the same scope, yeah.
I'm not sure we'll come back to that. Yeah.
So I would like just a couple of very quick comments and response to Jing Chao. So maybe starting with your last comment about the need to draw the line and how it can be difficult, I would like just to remind the board that we already have a line, and unless we were to require the acquisition method for all transactions within the scope of this project, we will have a line between what's in this project, what's in IFRS 3, and we already have seen all these questions about transitory control and what does it mean, and is it transitory, is it not transitory, and what if the transaction is conditional on an IPO, what does this mean for accounting? So we already have this uncertainty, and the only question we are trying to answer is where the line should be, as opposed to is there a line or is there no line. Again, unless we would require the acquisition method for everything. So this is the first point I wanted to make in response. And secondly, with regards to measurement uncertainty, we fully agree with you. When we started our analysis, we started conceptually from full fair value, and then we acknowledged, okay, it's too complex, too much measurement uncertainty. We moved to the ceiling approach, and after we already posted the paper, we developed those approaches further, and actually we hope that we have found a way how to bring the measurement uncertainty to the same levels as we currently have in IFRS 3. as opposed to, you know, higher levels. But watch the space, this will come.
It's a teaser. Tom?
Actually, it'll wait.
Wait, okay, tax.
Oh, right, okay. Just quickly, because most of the comment was made by Jinchao and Mary, but just let me put it in this way. So we need to consider the meaning of fair value of the business and the meaning of the equity contribution and the equity distribution. That is the thing we have to consider the meaning of. And actually, if I look at the slide 31, this is really interesting distinction between fair value and ceiling approach. And actually, the big shortcoming of full fair value is it could overstate goodwill or the grossed up the goodwill and the contribution, given that there is a measurement uncertainty of fair value of the business. That is the shortcoming of full fair value approach. But on the other hand, ceiling approach do not really provide the information about the fair value of the business. So then from the viewpoint of NCI, which information is more important? That is the question we need to consider in the future discussion. So I think, you know, there isn't not so many transactions like this. However, given that the BCUCC is not arm's length transaction, any transaction is possible. So from the viewpoint of protecting shareholders of NCI, what is the best method? That is what we need to consider. And I agree with most of what Jin Chao said. However, one thing I'm not quite sure if I could agree is whether or not we seek for just single transaction. Maybe there might be some variation would be necessary for BCUCC, and that is what we need to discuss seriously. Thank you.
Thank you. Gary?
Thank you. And like everybody else, very readable document, actually, when they say one picture's worth a thousand words. That's really... did it. Just a few observations, nothing necessarily profound or new. But first of all, I think both methods are worth exploring further. I think you articulated well, you know, both ceiling and the full fair value approaches. I guess IFRS 3, sometimes it's different. I do agree that probably no gain should be recognized. Ultimately, this is all self-dealing by P, you know, when you think through it all. I don't think a gain should flow through. Although technically in the conceptual framework, P might be a primary user, but I'm not so sure it's all that helpful to think of them in that light, because P controls themselves. They control A, they control B, they control the transaction. They get any information they want, when they want it, in the form they want it. So you're not a classic primary user in that sense. I don't know if that changes any analysis, but I think we should think of them as a controlling party as opposed to a primary user who can't get the information otherwise. I think Martin said it, but I think, but perhaps somebody else. I mean, I think when you look at P, not going to necessarily pay more than the fair value of what they're trying to give it away. They're not going to be in the business of giving the NCIs a gain. And likewise, they're probably not in a position to try to defraud NCI. So I think it's worthy of mentioning quickly, you're always keeping the appendix. In terms of ease of going forward, I would assume the fair value of the business and the fair value consideration are the same. And footnoted maybe in the back, if there's a difference, it could be an equity contribution or distribution, but I just wouldn't dwell on it at the moment. I mean, if NCI is the same class of shares as the 70% that P owns, I don't know how legally you can have a differentiating transaction in most of the countries I'm aware of, where 70% of a shareholder group gets one answer and 30% of the same shareholder group gets a different answer. Well, arguably, the NCI might be a different class of shares. as well, of which maybe you can get different treatment. But if you're a different class of shares, the chances are that's spelled out in the shareholder agreement or the underwriting agreement when you're actually going to be treated differently than the controlling party shareholders. So, again, I'm not sure how that factors into our work, but I think that's the reality of the situation. I think the disputes will be not that it should be at fair value. It's, as some said, it's the measurement uncertainty of what is fair value. Because by itself, fair value is not totally separable from the parent company. To the extent there's operational synergies, as other people mentioned, its fair value is affected by who owns it in this particular case. And what can P do for A? What can A do for P that might not independently exist absent this relationship? So just some, you know, thoughts, you know, for how to think about it going forward.
Thank you. Amara?
Thanks, Sue. I think I'll just repeat what others already said about the quality of the material. I really like it. I think it's an excellent example of an education session. The way you structured the material and the way you presented, I think it was excellent, really, for us as a starting point. I think you left it clearly that you are seeking comments on two aspects, on the conceptual element and the accounting method. On the conceptual side, I think you heard what is the key question for me in this project. So why the information for NCIs should or eventually is necessarily distinct from the information to others. I think this, we should focus on this to get to the core of the discussion. So I think this is the main element in terms of concept. As for the accounting method, I really like it. The fact that you consider our request to get the IFRS 3 as a starting point, and the fact that you build up from full fair value ceiling up to IFRS 3 really helped me in understanding the challenges in terms of the method to be eventually chosen at the end of the day. And I think that now it will be necessary really to streamline the advantage and disadvantages of each one, full fair value ceiling. You anticipated some. And why would we eventually choose a distinct one compared to IFRS 3 in terms of final presentation. And really, I would say you are in the right direction. I think you consider the feedback you heard before in terms of the direction of the project. And I think you have enough to explore these issues.
Peter, did you want to come on?
Yeah, so two or three people have talked about legal protections for the NCI and whether that has some bearing on the accounting. I mean, to my mind, that really has no bearing on the issues, that there may not be legal protections in every case, and even if there are legal protections, they may not always be complied with. If I give an analogy, investment funds often have restrictions on what they can invest in, but that doesn't mean that people always comply with investment restrictions, and the financial statements need to tell you what's gone on if people aren't complying with them. So I think we need to account for what's happened. If those restrictions are in place and they're being complied with, then that's fine, there's no problem anyway. But we have to design the accounting for the transactions that occur.
And my point was only different. I said to ask the management who has negotiated this transaction price or agreed to the transaction price, to ask him to come up and say the fair value is different from the transaction price. It's a difficult task to do for a management in a jurisdiction where that is not legally allowed. It wasn't.
Eventually.
I agree with Peter's comments, but also certainly in transactions I've worked on, you always need to be very careful that non-controlling interests aren't disadvantaged, and there's often, you know, a lot of restrictions to protect them. But in the direction where the acquisition may actually be made for less consideration, if you like, so entity B in your fact pattern was actually making a contribution to entity A, I'm not sure that that would necessarily be something that people would be unhappy with. If entity B, you know, knowingly was making that contribution, so maybe that direction's more likely to occur than the other because of shareholder protection, but Peter's point, I don't think we can necessarily assume, but maybe we need to think about how likely it is to occur in terms of the cost-benefit assessments.
Could we speak to some merger acquisition specialist? How often is this? I don't know. Is it quite often that you have out-of-fair-value transaction in business combination under common control if you have NCI shareholders? Is that really a kind of...
I think realistically it might be quite difficult to get a representative picture that we can rely on by form of outreach. I think what could be a better way to assess it is via a formal consultation on the next divorces document. Do we need to quickly summarize our main takeaways? So I think the main takeaway is that overall, there seems to be broad agreement with the analysis and direction, but that said, there are a few things for us to think about and bring back. So one particular point is about measurement uncertainty associated with the fair value of the acquired business, and the related point, how we're capturing synergies, which are not necessarily reflected in the fair value business per se from the point of view of market participant, but of course they would be taken into account by the acquirer. Also, we will come back to Mary's suggestions about how we order the analysis and maybe starting with question two rather than question one, but these are, I suppose, little refinements rather than, you know, changing the direction altogether. There were a number of comments around the need to think about other primary users, which, of course, we will bring back. It is on our list anyway. And other than that, I was very pleased to hear that the board was pleased with the slide deck. So my takeaway is on a very good job. Thank you very much.
Okay, and before we wrap up, that's a good point to say that this is, unfortunately, Anna Maria's last meeting with us, board meeting with us. So she joined us in July 2016 as a visiting fellow. She worked on the materiality practice statement, another excellent document, and then on BCUCC, and I think she's shown one of her core competencies today. Presentation and the way she presented. I know she's been a fully involved member of the technical staff, not just on the technical work, but on all the extracurricular activities. She's going back home to Milan to sounds like an exciting opportunity there. So we'll miss you, but all the best. And nobody ever fully escapes, I'm sure we'll see.
Thank you. Thank you.